Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Don't forget, we're moving up the dial to 101.1 FM. That is our new frequency and our new home. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Robert Knott, as we do every Friday, speaking of the arts. I'd like to welcome now Jamil Jaffer. He's a litigator for the American Civil Liberties Union and director of the ACLU's National Security Program. Welcome, Jamil.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
You are the director of the ACLU's National Security Program, and you've got a number of court cases. One of them is ACLU versus NSA. Tell us about it.
Well, that's a case that challenges a program that was disclosed by the New York Times in January of last year. You may remember that there was a front-page article in the Times that disclosed the existence of a warrantless surveillance program inside the United States. That program raised a number of concerns for us. First, we think that warrantless surveillance generally violates the Fourth Amendment, which protects against unreasonable searches and seizures. But warrantless surveillance also violates a statute that Congress enacted in 1978 called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And that statute requires the president or federal agencies to go to a court, a secret intelligence court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, to get warrants before they engage in wiretapping or surveillance physical searches inside the United States.
What's the foreign aspect of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act?
Well, this is about, it's supposed to be about the surveillance of suspected foreign agents, so people who are associated with foreign governments or people who are associated with foreign organizations, terrorist organizations, for example, who are working inside the United States. And this act, this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, was meant to regulate that kind of surveillance. And the act was passed because of all kinds of abuses that successive presidents engaged in during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And Congress passed the act in 1978 to ensure that those kinds of abuses wouldn't take place again. And that's the act that President Bush decided after 9/11 that he did not have to comply with.
How was that the NSA warrantless wiretapping uncovered?
Well, it was disclosed initially by the New York Times. They were able to find some anonymous sources to talk about it. We now know that there was actually quite a bit of dissent about the government's foreign intelligence activities, including this warrantless wiretapping program, within the government itself. And so presumably what happened is that some of those people who dissented went to the Times and said, you know, here's what's going on. So the Times disclosed quite a bit about the program, and then the President and the Attorney General confirmed the existence of the program in news conferences. And after that happened, we filed a lawsuit on behalf of a coalition of journalists, researchers, and attorneys to challenge this program. And we made the argument that the President didn't have the authority to ignore the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. If he wanted to engage in surveillance inside the United States, he had to first obtain warrants, as that act requires and as the Fourth Amendment requires.
And which is still not, it seems that the Bush administration is always playing the security card. In other words, if we go for a warrant, then that information will jeopardize what we're doing. But what you're talking about is getting warrants even under a secret...
From a secret court.
A secret court.
Right. No, this court is set up... You know, this court is not one that's known to be particularly sympathetic to civil liberties concerns. This court has been around since 1978. Over the last 30 years, it's heard about 30,000 surveillance applications from the government. And of those 30,000, the court has granted all but about five. Not 5,000, five. So it's not a court that has previously been an obstacle to foreign intelligence surveillance inside the United States. And it's a little strange that the government thought, that the president thought, that even that court was too much of an obstacle. And the president, you know, as you say, has been making the argument that national security requires that he engage in all this surveillance he's been engaged in. But the argument we're making is not that the president shouldn't be permitted to engage in surveillance of suspected terrorists, but rather that there should be a court that oversees that surveillance to ensure that it is actually directed at suspected terrorists and not instead at, for example, political dissidents who are doing nothing more than disagreeing with government policies. So, you know, that's what we're arguing about, not whether the government can engage in surveillance, but what kinds of safeguards should be in place.
And so what happened with this case? You brought the case forward.
Right, and we filed a case in Michigan, a district court in Michigan, and a judge in Michigan initially ruled that the president was acting unlawfully. The judge agreed with us on all counts. The judge agreed that the president was violating the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The judge agreed that the president was violating the First and Fourth Amendments. And so the judge prohibited the president from engaging in warrantless wiretapping in wiretapping inside the United States, except in compliance with statutory law. And that's where we were until about 3 weeks ago, when an appeals court in Michigan overturned that decision. It was a 2-1 decision. Two judges didn't reach the merits at all, didn't reach the constitutional issues or the statutory issues. Instead, what they said was the ACLU's plaintiffs don't have standing to challenge this program at all. And their argument was that unless we can show that our plaintiffs have themselves been wiretapped under this program, they don't have standing to challenge the program at all.
Now, that is a deep catch-22, because how are you supposed to know if surveillance has been enacted on you if it's a secret program?
Right, right. No, that's exactly right. I mean, I think it's, you know, it borders on the Kafkaesque, I think. You know, what the judges are saying by saying that you can't challenge this kind of program unless you can show that you've been, you know, you can't challenge this kind of secret program unless you can show that you yourself have been monitored.
In which case,
really
it wouldn't
saying,
be a secret.
Exactly. And what they're essentially saying is that nobody can challenge the program. And that's not an answer we like at all. And it's an answer that I think has broad ramifications even beyond this context to all kinds of surveillance activities that the government may be engaging in or may engage in the future.
So where does it go from here?
Well, we haven't decided yet exactly how we're going to proceed. But one thing that we know is that we're not going to let that kind of decision stand uncontested. You know, we have a number of different possibilities. We could go back to the Sixth Circuit and ask the entire Sixth Circuit, so all of the judges on that Court of Appeals, to reconsider the decision. Or we could petition the Supreme Court to get involved in the case. And, you know, the current Supreme Court is, I think, widely believed to be quite conservative. But I do think that there would be a number of justices on this Supreme Court who would be immensely troubled by the proposition that the president believes that he's above the law. And that's essentially what this case is about. The president is saying that he has the inherent authority to ignore statutory law whenever he believes that national security requires him to do so. And that, you know, that proposition could be applied in all kinds of contexts. If the president can ignore the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, what other laws can he ignore? Can he ignore the Detainee Treatment Act, which prohibits torture? Can he ignore the Patriot Act, which in some instances restricts what the government can do in the way of surveillance inside the United States? There are all kinds of contexts in which that proposition would have a significant effect.
We're talking to Jamil Jaffer of the American Civil Liberties Union. What we know about the warrantless wiretapping program, the warrantless surveillance program, is from the people who leaked this information to the New York Times. Do we have any details on the extent to which it was potentially abused? In other words, whether surveillance was carried out on people for political reasons rather than national security reasons?
Well, this is what we do know. We know that the warrantless surveillance program was used to intercept conversations between attorneys and their clients, because there is an organization in Oregon that had been designated as a terrorist organization, a blacklisted organization. And in the course of litigation to challenge that designation, the government inadvertently disclosed a document that confirms, I haven't seen the document myself, but from the legal papers I know this, a document that confirms that attorney-client communications were intercepted. And that is extremely troubling, because our entire justice system depends on attorney-client confidentiality, the principle that communications between an attorney and the attorney's client have to be kept confidential even against government interests on the other side. That's kind of maybe the most fundamental principle of the American justice system.
So that's yet another violation of the law besides violating the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Act.
Yeah, I mean, I think that... one of the most frustrating things about this entire issue is the secrecy that surrounds the government surveillance. I mean, we already talked about how that secrecy has affected our ability to challenge the government's activities. But we also know very little about how the government surveillance powers have actually been used. One thing that we do know is that the government would not have found it necessary to go around the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in this way if it could actually satisfy the requirements of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And so my suspicion, and this is, I think, confirmed by some government statements, is that the government went around FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, not because it couldn't meet the probable cause requirement, because it was engaging in surveillance of people with respect to whom it didn't have probable cause to believe they're actually foreign agents.
Let's talk about Doe versus Gonzalez. That's the challenge to the FBI's National Security Letter Authority.
Right. That's another surveillance case that we've been litigating. We brought this case in 2004 on behalf of an internet service provider that had received what's called the National Security Letter from the FBI. And the FBI had demanded that this internet service provider disclose information about its subscribers. And this internet service provider believed that the demand was improper, was unconstitutional, and wanted to challenge the demand in court. The problem was that along with this demand, the FBI had issued a gag order that prevented this ISP from disclosing even the mere fact that the FBI had asked it for information.
So you had, that's why it's DOE.
That's why it's DOE.
As opposed to
right.
AOL or whoever
right,
it was.
Right. And so for the last 3 years, we've been litigating this case under a kind of blanket of secrecy. We still can't disclose the name of our client, but we're challenging the FBI's authority to issue these unilateral gag orders that are effectively permanent. We don't dispute that the FBI may have an interest in secrecy in certain rare cases. There may have to be a gag order that's temporary that prevents an ISP or whoever at a library or university from disclosing certain facts about an FBI investigation. But we're very troubled by the idea that the FBI has this power unilaterally, that it's not overseen by any court. And that to the extent somebody challenges this kind of gag order in court, there's a statute now that requires the court to defer to the FBI's determination that secrecy is necessary. And so the court review that is available is really meaningless. It's just a cosmetic thing.
So basically the checks and balances are pretty much non-existent in that particular case.
Right. I think you see the same pattern as you do with the National Security Agency. You see the executive branch trying to cut the courts out of the conversation. They want, the president wants a kind of exclusive authority to make decisions relating to national security, and that's never been the way the American Constitution works. There's always been shared power between the three branches on national security issues. There was one Supreme Court decision, one of the detention cases in which Sandra Day O'Connor wrote that the executive branch doesn't have a blank check when it comes to national security issues and the civil liberties of Americans. But that's precisely what the administration has been asking for, both in the NSA case and in the National Security Letter case, a blank check.
We're talking to Jamil Jaffer from the ACLU. In the case where they wanted information from this internet service provider, what information did they want?
That is still under seal. We can't disclose that, but... we had another case, another National Security Letter case, which we also filed under seal initially, and we challenged the gag order, arguing that we should be allowed to disclose the names of our clients and that our clients should be allowed to talk about it. And we won that about a year and a half ago. And so now I can say that our clients in that case are four librarians who are associated with an organization called Library Connection. And they've been very outspoken since the gag was lifted about the effect of this law and their view that the secrecy surrounding national security letters is extraordinary and overbroad and dangerous. They have disclosed that the national security letter that was served on them asked for information about library patrons' usage of computers in libraries. So
So in other words, if let's say I went to the library and I did 10 Google searches, they would want to know what my Google searches were, what I was looking for, that kind of thing?
You know, with a national security letter, the government can find out all kinds of sensitive information of that kind. So the names of the websites you visited, the names of the people with whom you've exchanged emails, a list of people who have visited a particular website. I mean, let's say they think that, you know, people who visited Fox News or Al Jazeera or whatever it is, the Federalist Society's website, you know, are suspicious. They can start collecting those names through national security letters. And, you know, obviously the FBI is going to have an interest sometime in getting that kind of information. Our argument is not about whether the FBI should be allowed to collect information or not. Our argument is first about, you know, the safeguards that apply to the FBI when it does want to collect that information, and second, to the extent and nature of this gag order that the FBI can issue. We don't think that the FBI should have the exclusive authority, unchecked by any court, to silence whoever it wants to.
All the questions that you are talking about get into the distinction between proper use of power and abuse of power. And, you know, having grown up during the Cold War and having been indoctrinated that what they did in Eastern Europe and in East Germany and Russia was very bad, how does, and I don't know if this is something you've really looked at in a comparative way, but how does where we stand now compare to a kind of, you know, communist Cold War era surveillance that was clearly going on and that we were told, you know, in school and at home was a very bad thing, mm-hmm. back in the, you know, 70s and 80s?
Right. I mean, I do think that there are certain very troubling parallels there's certainly tendencies in some of these policies we see now that are very troubling. I wish there were a slightly less extreme way of saying this, but I think that there are totalitarian tendencies in some of these policies, and you know, that's, I think, extremely troubling to the ACLU, obviously, but should be extremely troubling to Americans more generally. You also see a lot of parallels between the policies that the Bush administration is introducing now and the discredited policies that the United States government used during the Cold War against suspected communists. I'll just give you one example. We're increasingly seeing foreign scholars excluded from the United States because of their political views, and that's something we saw during the Cold War. And when the government was given the power to exclude foreign scholars because of their political views, the government excluded people like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Pierre Trudeau, the former Canadian Prime Minister.
Which is unbelievable.
It's crazy. Pablo Neruda, Doris Lessing. You know, these people are not national security threats and never were. And those are the same kinds of people who are being excluded under similar authorities today.
Well, you had a case like that, a Swiss scholar, Tariq Ramadan.
Right. That's an ongoing case. We represent three American organizations, the American Association of University Professors, the American Academy of Religion, and Penn American Center, in a challenge to the government's refusal to grant Professor Ramadan a visa. And Tariq Ramadan is a sometimes controversial figure, but he's somebody who's extremely well-respected in Europe. He's a professor at the University of Oxford now. He had been offered a tenure job at the University of Notre Dame, which is not a notably radical university, and the government interfered with that job offer, and essentially a week before he was supposed to take up his position, revoked his visa. And since then, we've been challenging that decision. The government's initial argument was that it had revoked his visa because he had endorsed terrorism. And we thought that was absurd because we took a look at his writings, and he's been very consistent in his opposition to terrorism. He has criticized American foreign policy, but he has never endorsed terrorism. And so we made that argument in court, and the judge agreed with us and said the government has not presented any evidence whatsoever that Professor Ramadan has endorsed terrorism. And the judge required the government to either let him in or explain, you know, provide a new explanation for why he should be kept out. And so the government hemmed and hawed and eventually said, well, we have another reason we're keeping him out. In 1998, he gave a couple hundred dollars to two European charities, incidentally, that still operate lawfully in Europe today. And these charities, in turn, gave money to Hamas. These charities at the time were not only operating lawfully in Europe, but had not been blacklisted by the U.S. government. They were blacklisted 5 years later. And the U.S. government is now trying to retroactively apply that blacklisting to donations of a few hundred dollars that he gave to, again, European charities that still operate lawfully in Europe today.
Because he wasn't psychic enough to know that 5 years later his organization would be blacklisted.
It's a transparently pretextual reason for keeping him out. I think it's plain that the government is concerned, not that Tariq Ramadan is a national security threat, but he may say something that's critical of U.S. foreign policy, and he's somebody who's prominent and has a platform, somebody people listen to. And they think that the easiest way to deal with people like him is just to keep him out in the first place.
You were also involved in a case called ACLU versus Department of Defense. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, we were talking about the secrecy that surrounds all of these national security policies that have been introduced over the last few years. We became very concerned a few years ago, about 6 months before the Abu Ghraib photographs were leaked to the press, that prisoners were being abused and tortured in U.S. custody in overseas detention centers. And so we filed a Freedom of Information Act request asking for documents concerning the treatment of prisoners. And over the last 4 years or 3 years, I guess we have we've obtained more than 100,000 pages about the treatment of prisoners. And those pages make clear that the abuse of prisoners was not limited to Abu Ghraib, that it took place at detention centers in Iraq, Afghanistan, and at Guantanamo Bay. And perhaps more troubling still, that to a large extent, the abuse and even torture of prisoners was endorsed and in some cases expressly authorized by senior military and civilian officials. And that's something that I think still has not been grappled with by Congress and even by the American public. I think it's something that has somehow been glossed over. I think that there have been two narratives that have grown up around torture. One is the ticking bomb narrative, and the other is the narrative that the administration offered around the Abu Ghraib photographs, which is that these are rogue soldiers. And those two narratives kind of miss the actual facts. And so what we've been trying to do is, to the extent we can, publicize these documents that we've got. We're putting together a book, actually, the documents that will hopefully be released in November. That book will select some of these documents and try to explain the significance of these documents and why we think that these documents show responsibility at the highest levels.
The highest level being the Secretary of Defense, or?
No, well, including the Secretary of Defense, but I would also include the President, Attorney General, he was then White House Counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, who's the one who recommended that the Geneva Conventions essentially be scrapped when it came to the interrogation of prisoners at Guantanamo. And General Jeffrey Miller, who was in charge of Guantanamo at the time that a lot of this abuse took place.
Now, you have documents that demonstrate all of this.
We do. And in fact, they're up on our website right now. They have been. But I think that it's been part of the problem we've had is that we have so many documents up there that just the number is overwhelming and people don't know how to process them. So the purpose of this book, which I wrote with another ACLU attorney, Amrit Singh, is to try to select the most significant documents and show how they sort of draw this connection between the policies that were adopted at the highest levels and what actually took place on the ground.
I'm interested in the question of dissent. There's the things that you were talking about on all levels, from national security to letters to the NSA surveillance program, visas, activities in Guantanamo. There are many decent people with conscience working within these agencies. There seems to be some dissent in the form of the leaking of documents, the leaking of photographs, but not really that much. What do you think is going on?
Well, you know, one of the things that we did discover through this FOIA litigation about the abuse of prisoners is that there was a lot of dissent within the government about these policies. The first documents we got were FBI emails that showed FBI agents, in which FBI agents wrote about interrogations that they had witnessed and expressed grave concerns both about the effectiveness of the military's interrogation techniques and also about the legality of those techniques. And then we started to get documents from the Defense Department as well that showed that some people in the Department of Defense had expressed concerns about these policies. And we now know, for example, that Alberto Mora, who was then the General Counsel of the Navy, went to great lengths to try to get Secretary Rumsfeld to change the policies that were leading to the abuse of prisoners at Guantanamo. So there really were, there really was quite a bit of dissent, even within the government. And I think that, you know, the efforts of, that those people took are really admirable and something that, you know, I think we owe them a lot for having made those efforts. Unfortunately, in many cases, those efforts were unsuccessful. And the policies were reaffirmed by people like Secretary Rumsfeld, even after people had expressed grave concerns about them.
We're talking to Jamil Jaffer of the ACLU. There's one more thing I wanted to talk about before we go, and that is that on the 17th of July of this year, an executive order came out from the White House called Blocking Property of Certain Persons Who Threaten Stabilization Efforts in Iraq. And it comes straight from the President of the United States. And I've read it through a number of times, and I'm having trouble understanding what it's really all about. It's an executive order basically saying that the property of anybody who threatens the stabilization of Iraq or the peace effort of Iraq can be seized by the Treasury Department.
Right, which actually sounds quite reasonable on its face, but the problem is that it goes on to say that anyone who provides material support to people who threaten the stability of Iraq, they're also liable to have their property seized. And material support is defined so broadly that it includes even people who provide only humanitarian aid. So, for example, if somebody sends books or sends medical supplies with the intent that they be used for humanitarian purposes only, that person can nonetheless be liable under this executive order. And this is actually part of a broader pattern in which the administration has been moving out from the people who've actually been engaged in violent activity to people who are 1 degree removed or 2 degrees removed or 3 degrees removed from those people. And, you know, you initially start with material support writ narrowly, and then you go to material support writ broadly, and then you go to endorsing violent activity, like you see with the ideological exclusion provisions that have been used against Professor Ramadan. And it keeps going out and out and out, and ultimately you have people who've done nothing more than contribute to legitimate charities with the intent that their money be used to support legitimate activities like schools or hospitals, and those kinds of people are suddenly criminally liable. And we think that that is, well, first, profoundly unfair to the people who have provided that support for entirely laudable reasons, but also that it has a real chilling effect on humanitarian aid that is desperately needed.
What do you think is the intention of it?
You know, I think that the chilling effect is part of the intention, and I think that that's true. I mean, you see that more clearly when it comes to things like ideological exclusion. I think that when the government makes it off limits to endorse violent activity, then you start to get into an area in which you're talking not about people who are inciting violent activity, but rather just engaging in ordinary scholarship about, you know, for example, somebody writes about the motivations of suicide bombers or something like that. As somebody expresses sympathy for the political complaints that have been made by, for example, suicide bombers, is that person endorsing violent activity? Is that person endorsing terrorism? And obviously, we don't want, we're totally sympathetic to the government's efforts to combat actual terrorism, but at the same time, we think it has to be done in a way that's consistent with the First Amendment and that continues to allow academic freedom to thrive, the freedom of political debate to thrive. And we think that all of these laws, the material support laws, the ideological exclusion laws, can have both unintended and intended consequences for academic freedom and the freedom of political debate.
Jamil Jaffer from the ACLU. He's a litigator for the American Civil Liberties Union and director of the ACLU's National Security Program. Anything you want to add before we go?
No, I think you covered it all.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back with Robert Knott in just a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome Robert Knott. He is associate editor of the Posse Tiempo Friday Art Supplement in the Santa Fe, New Mexican. And he is here snoring with us every Friday. Snoring of the arts.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you?
All right. How are you?
That was a pretty good interview. I listened to the first part of it.
Very interesting indeed.
What's interesting is when I got out of the military like 22 years ago, I applied for a job at NSA. And then I changed my mind and decided I didn't want to do it. So I became a bartender.
Well, that's a good thing, I guess.
That I became a bartender?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, look at me now. I've had a meteoric climb. There's about 35 gallery openings tonight listed in the Pasatiempo calendar, page 102, and I'll just list like the first five or six to give you a sense of what's happening. Blue Rain Gallery, 130 Lincoln Avenue, has New Directions, drawings, paintings, and 3D works by Tony Abeta. Reception is 5:30 to 7:30. They're on Lincoln Avenue. The Box Gallery has monotypes and paintings by Kathleen Morris. It's called New Paint. Reception 5 to 7 p.m. Canyon Road Contemporary Art at 403 Canyon Road has paintings and sculpture by Jean Wallen called Inside Outside. I wrote about her about 4 years ago. Convergence Gallery has The Medicine Show. That's a group show featuring celebrating the release of Luis Mel Madrona's book, Narrative Medicine, the Use of History and Story in the Healing Process. So there's a reception and a book signing at Convergence tonight, 5:30 to 7:30, at 219 West San Francisco Street. Downey Gallery, 225 Canyon, has a group show of Russian Impressionist paintings. I wonder who they're trying to impress. El Gancho, of all places, at an old Las Vegas highway, has Medina Croce, if I mispronounce the name. New paintings, reception 5 to 7. I didn't know a steakhouse was having an art opening, but everybody's doing that these days. Even this place has art.
Santa Fe Baking Company does indeed. The work of Mickey Bond.
Meanwhile, there's works on paper. Mickey Bond. Works on paper by Linda Hunsaker called Beasts, Etc. at El Zaguan, 545 Canyon Road. And Farnsworth Gallery at 716 Canyon Road has paintings by John Farnsworth. It's the Old Masters series, based on Old Masters paintings. That's just like the first seven or eight, but I do have to jump ahead because I told somebody I would, and plug Skier's Edge at 1836 Cerrillos Road, which has a summer showcase area where they show art. Have you been there?
Yeah, no, I haven't, but I know all about it. It's very cool. And ski shop by in the winter and in the summer.
It's an art show place.
Art
it's
show
photo
place. It's really cool.
So we've got digital imagery by John Durbansky, and we have mixed media and ceramic sculpture work by Barbara Ingram. John also has woodcuts and prints, and it's called Myth and Imagination. And it's from 5 to 7 p.m. tonight is the reception. It runs through the end of August, 1836 Cerrillos Road, by the Pantry Restaurant, which I love that French toast at. And you ought to head down to Skier's Edge. And I think that deserves a song, actually. If I could come up with some lyrics, I would. Remember that old Doris Day movie, Teacher's Pet?
Have you seen any movies made after 1965?
Anyway, she sings this song, and it goes, Teacher's Pet, I want to be Teacher's Pet. So I was just thinking, you know, like, Skier's Edge, you gotta go down to Skier's Edge. Don't sit on the ledge or take your bets to hedge. You gotta go to Skier's Edge.
That was Cerrillos. Extemporaneous song by Robert Knott. Excellent.
Well, I'm pretty irascible to people in general. They kind of like me. Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. I don't know.
You're irascible, and so they like you.
Yeah, I'm irascible. You know how some people are irascible to women? That's how
you
I
mean
am.
Irresistible?
That's the word I was looking for. It's a good thing one of us had it. Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival.
It's a good thing you're irresistible. Otherwise, you wouldn't get away with this stuff. Felines and Friends, a cat rescue organization, is holding a pet adoption at Petco this Saturday, August 4th, from 12 to 3. This week's cat of the week is Nino, an affectionate bobtail silver male kitty who would make a wonderful addition to any home except for mine, where he'd get eaten by Milk and Honey.
Aww.
He's a real cute little cuddle bug. Again, the adoption Saturday, Petco, 12 to 3. For more information, call 316-CAT-1.
That's a pretty good phone number.
I think so.
You're a cool cat yourself. Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, as I was extemporaneously speaking about earlier, has pianist Alan Feinberg in recital with new music by Judith Weir, Paul Reuters, Javanshir Kuliyev, and others at 6 p.m. tonight, St. Francis Auditorium, which is in the New Mexico Museum of Art, 107 West Palace Avenue. We do have a story on that in today's Pasatiempo. There's some theater stuff happening. Pilar Passarelli and Quinn Armstrong are teaming up to do a Christopher Durang comedy called Laughing Wild. Opens at the Playhouse tonight at 7:30. There's a piece on that in Pasatiempo. And I do want to mention, if you feel like you want to go somewhere with the family or the kids, you want to get out of the house and you want to feel like the olden days when men were men and women were happy about that, the El Rancho de las Golondrinas Summer Festival.
We're not happy now?
Well, things are a little different now. I mean, you know, women are figuring out they don't necessarily have to be with men in order to have a full life of fullness. So
whatever you say, Robert. Go ahead.
anyway, and mountain men are, and mountain women are going to demonstrate their skills out there at El Rancho de las Golondrinas, tell stories. And among the antics they're going to be pulling is tomahawk throwing. Can you imagine going to witness that? Remember that guy in Daniel Boone that used to do that, his Indian sidekick? That guy was great. They're going to pan for gold, which is going to be fun to watch. There's no water around here. And they're going to do some hide tanning. Now, I don't know about you, but when I tan my hide, I go out back privately in my little enclosed backyard, and I discreetly take off my towel. That's how, so to watch somebody doing that's going to be kind of embarrassing. There's also going to be food and music and other stuff. It's from 10 to 4 starting today at El Rancho de las Golondrinas at 334 Los Pinos Road, and there's a phone number you have to call, which is 471-2261. You don't have to call it, but you could, and there's different ages and different prices for those ages, so go on out there, and that takes place all this weekend.
Speaking of all this weekend, the Hiroshima commemoration is August 3rd and 4th. That's today and tomorrow. Today at 4 o'clock, there's a mass at Santa Maria de la Paz with Father John Deere at 11 College Avenue, right off of Richards Avenue, right near the Santa Fe Community College, and at 7 o'clock, Father Roy Bourgeois, founder of the School of America's Watch, will be speaking at El Museo Cultural. There's a suggested donation at that, but not necessary. And then tomorrow at 9 in the morning to noon, nonviolence training at Santa Maria de la Paz. And from 2 to 4, Pax Christi, New Mexico's sackcloth and ashes at Ashley Pond in Los Alamos. And then more stuff at Ashley Pond, speakers, Mayor David Koss will be there. Father Roy Bourgeois, many others. And finally, at 7:30 to 9, lantern floating ceremony on Ashley Pond. There will be floating 3,000 little lanterns. Each one commemorates 100 victims of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
That's terrific. And while Paso Tiempo itself doesn't have a big story on this, our cover image is from a 1955 shot taken by Vivian Cherry of some women who were protesting atomic weapons back in 1955. We do have a mixed media with all the information, and there's a lot happening. It is Peace Day weekend, and it'd be good for everybody to be peaceful. Be nice if you and I were peaceful.
We are peaceful.
We are?
We are the milk of human kindness. We're sharing that glass of milk.
That's right. We started that around New Year's, and overall, I think we've been pretty, what would you call it?
Peaceful.
Yes, you would call it that. Tonight, if you like, Alan Arkin and Jonathan Richards and Bruce Dunlop are teaming up for music and poetry. Other shenanigans, I'm sure. 7:30 p.m. at GIG, 1808 2nd Street. You got to pay to get in. You can go to a performance by John Rangel playing some jazz as part of the Music with O'Keefe series in the Georgia O'Keefe Museum Courtyard downtown on Johnson Street, 5 to 8 p.m. That's free, by the way. Santa Fe County Fair continues this weekend. It's out there in the county fairgrounds, 3229 Rodeo Road. No charge, although you go and you end up buying like cotton candy and hot dogs and corn on the cob. They have a beer. They have some country western music. You get dancing. You get on one of those rides like the loop-de-loop, and the next thing you know, you've lost 8 pounds or something because of the, you know, getting sick on the things. Did you ever get on a ride and then scream to get off?
No.
I went on this ride in upstate New York like 5 years ago with my nephew. It was like some sort of bullet roller coaster, and they said, sit in the front seat. It's the best view. So I get in this thing. It takes off like a rocket in the air. It starts going upside down. You know, the only thing holding you in is like your gravity and your sheer terror of falling. I'm screaming the whole time. I'm like, stop, stop, get off. I want to stop. Everybody thought that was funny. Nobody stopped, by the way. I've never gotten on a roller coaster since then.
Well, if you stop when it's in the upside down part, then that's really bad.
Oh, so it's a good thing they kept it going, huh?
Exactly.
Because that's how
that's
I got back to the climatic thing.
Centrifugal force.
Well, not just that, but it's the thing that keeps you in your seat against all gravity. On Saturday, the 35th Annual Girls Incorporated Arts and Crafts Show takes place on and around the plaza. Over 200 artists are going to take part. It's from 9 to 6 p.m. It's free. Swing on down to the plaza. I want to mention that NDI of New Mexico has a Broadway scene performance show called the Broadway Theater Dance Workshop. It's at 4 and 7 p.m. Saturday at the Dance Barns, and they brought in some really talented choreographers and directors, some who are well-known and some who are not, but all of whom are very talented, and they've put together a show that's going to be really exciting to see, I think. I'm hoping to go see it. I wrote a piece about it in today's Paso Tiempo, so take a look at that. Susan Abode is going to be performing with the John Law Trio at 8:30 p.m. Saturday at Silver Starlight Lounge at Rainbow Vision Santa Fe on 500 Rodeo Road. I haven't been out there yet, have you?
No, I haven't been out to Rainbow Vision. I've seen it, gone past it.
I ran into Dadu, the guy that, you know, does the accordion.
Dadu's great.
He is?
Yeah.
Oh, that's terrific.
He's an accordionist.
That's right. He's the guy.
My father was an accordionist. I have a soft spot for accordionists.
Do you?
Yes.
Ah, that's one instrument I'll have to take up here. Anyway, he tells me
I already have a soft spot for you, Robert.
Oh, that's nice. He tells me that it's a neat place and that people need to get out there to see stuff. So Susan Abad's there this week. Remember Catherine Donovan did that Rosemary Clooney thing there a couple weeks ago? So head on out there.
Hey, the Mosaic Dance Company is performing at Fusion tonight and in 2 weeks from tonight also at 7 o'clock. There's no cover charge, but reservations are required.
Let's say that you like opera. You're
Let's
going out
that.
With this guy, and he's not too keen on opera. He's a cowboy. He's got a hat and a couple of cowboy boots. Maybe even he carries a six gun. You could call him an old cowhand from the Rio Grande. He wants barbecue. You got the perfect date to make you guys work together. And I rarely play matchmaker because I don't usually carry matches. I have a lighter myself. I don't even smoke, but usually I'm burning. Anyway, Sunday.
What on earth are you talking about,
on
Robert?
On Sunday, the second annual Arias and Ribs takes place. And it's a performance of light operatic fare and musical comedy by the Santa Fe Opera Apprentices. And this is 6 o'clock Sunday at the Bishop's Lodge Ranch Resort and Spa. And you got to pay to get in. And it's not too bad. And you also get barbecue. You get ribs.
Ribs are good.
So the cowboy goes and he gets his ribs. He's sitting by the pool looking at some of the young ladies that are visiting, hopefully attired in bikini fare. And the young lady gets to hear her operatic stuff. Or you can vice versa. Maybe it's the guy that's a staid, stuffy guy in a tux. And the girl's, you know, Texas with a toothpick in her mouth, which is, you know, perfect. My kind of gal. Anyway, so that's Sunday at 5. No, make it 6. Move it back an hour in case of the time change. Maybe you set the clocks back.
What do you mean time change? It's not time change till October.
It's not?
No.
No wonder I woke up early this morning, an hour early. I had to go and set the... Flamenco's Next Generation is a performance by Maria Benitez's youth company Monday nights, 8:30, at the Lodge at Santa Fe. That's the same night that the Middle Eastern dance troupe Ajata and Almaz performs at 7 p.m. at Body of Santa Fe. When a body meets a body, coming to Body. There's something else happening at Body. You know what it is? Julie Brett Adams and Kate Eberle are teaming
up. Yes, two women dancing.
Yeah, they're teaming up with this guy that plays...
Timothée Marcel.
Huh?
A young French cellist.
There we go.
Playing the Bach solo cello suites.
That's right. So he's going to play while they dance. So this is...
I went to the rehearsal. I've seen this in action. And he sort of almost plays the role of a dancer because... of the very graceful movements of his body while he plays the cello, and they sort of move him around the stage.
Well, the cello, isn't that sort of shaped like a...
Are you trying to say the word woman?
Well, I wasn't going to incorporate that necessarily, but I was trying to refer it in some sort of manner. But, yeah, that's something like that. So, okay, so when is that? Do you know? I know Craig Smith wrote about it in today's Positampo, but I don't have the info.
Check your Positampo, ladies and gentlemen. I don't think I brought the flyer.
Okay, thank you. High Mayhem, Tuesday night. You want to head over there and hear Captain Ahab, the guy that chased that whale around the seven seas, who looked a lot like Gregory Peck?
Oh, look, I found it. Two Women Dancing
right
is
in.
Tomorrow, Sunday, and then next weekend, Saturday and Sunday at Body, 9860362 for more information.
That's good. Thank you. Where was I? Oh, yeah, High Mayhem, Tuesday night, 9 o'clock. They're over on Lena Street. And they've got the instrumental quartet Hyde Red Center, the electro dance group Captain Ahab, and Santa Fe Improv Art Noise Collective, Bull Seal. What's an Improv Art Noise Collective? What do you make of that?
Improv Art Noise Collective?
Yeah.
I have not the slightest.
Well, you want to find out. It's at 9 o'clock on Tuesday at the High Mayhem Performance Studios.
It'd probably be fun if you were making the noise. It'd probably be really, really fun if you were making the improvised art noise.
I do that all
Listening
the time.
Listening to it might be really fun, too.
Oh, so you're saying that listening to me as I improv noise is good, too.
No, you're actually speaking. It's not just noise. You're speaking intelligible English words.
I am?
Strung together in sentence or sentence-like constructions.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I've never been so grammatically praised before in my life. On Tuesday night also, the Stray Cats, one of my favorite groups, still going after all these years, 8 o'clock, Camel Rock Casino, Tasuki Pueblo, 10 miles north of Santa Fe. Got to pay to get in. Check out Ticketmaster.com. Wednesday night is the beginning of the Mountain Mad trade show, which is different from the Mountain Men at El Rancho de las Golondrinas. There's like quarreling mountain men. It started years ago with the Hatfields and the McCoys, and then Sears and Roebuck got involved, and Romeo and Juliet, all these feuding people. I don't know what the problem is. Everybody should try to get along.
And then you and me.
Yeah. You and me. That's right. Well, look at us. We're
the Hatfields and the McCoys.
We've extended the poison ivy branch of peace amongst each other. We've got an itch for each other. That's okay. The 23rd Annual Mountain Man Trade Show is starting Wednesday night at the Palace of the Governors downtown. It is free if you go through the blue gates on Lincoln Avenue. But if you go into the museum, you got to pay. And then you got to go out the back door of the museum and you find the mountain men waiting for you, laughing at you because you went through the museum and paid, although it's good to go to the museum. Also Wednesday night, Sharon Udall, art culture historian, is going to talk about women artists who worked in the Taos and Santa Fe colonies back in olden days, like 1914 to 1960. Although the latter part of those olden days is about the time I was born. I was just a baby in those days. I didn't even know how old I was. Anyway, this is in conjunction with the Women Artists of New Mexico. Don't make me laugh with you. She's doing faces.
I am not.
Addison Rowe Fine Art has a show called Women Artists of New Mexico, and this is part of that. And it's at 5:30 on Wednesday and goes to 7:30. And it's at 924 Paseo de Peralta in Suite 9. And there's no charge, but you got to get reservations to go to the Sharon Udall lecture, which is at 5:30. So call this number, 982-1533. Thursday night, CCA, Dialogue 360, Artists in Conversation. And they're going to have Norman Akers and Kerry Atombe, pardon me if I mispronounce names, it's never intentional. They're going to, Institute of American Indian Arts Instructors and Artists, and they're going to talk about their work at 6 p.m. Thursday at the Center for Contemporary Arts, which is at 1050 Old Pecos Trail. Very cheap to get in. We can't mention prices on KSFR 90.7. Your wonderful community
101.1
station, which is
now
going to 101.1.
We're already there.
You are?
Yeah, we're simulcasting.
Then why am I listening to 90.7? I have 90.7 on my Jeep. What are you telling me?
I'm saying we're simulcasting. We're on both stations, but eventually we're only going to be on 101.1.
Oh, this is a segue. So one morning I'm going to wake up and I'm going to listen to 90.7 and you're not going to be there.
Well, then you switch to 101.1. You should switch now because it's a stronger signal.
I want to stay with you, though.
It's 101.1.
How can you be on two stations at once?
Because we are.
Are you like
Try
the Patty
it.
Duke show? With it? Remember that show? Wasn't that great?
Yes, I remember the Patty Duke show.
Why are you being so anticipatory about it? It was a fun show.
What am I anticipating?
It was just that great theme song, remember? It was like...
But they're cousins, identical cousins, and you'll find...
Like,
they laugh alike, they walk alike.
Everywhere from old Baghdad to New Bel Air. But Patty's the type that's only seen it from Brooklyn Heights. What a crazy pair.
It was from Zanzibar to Barclays Square. Let's move on.
But how did you know the words then?
Because I was very, very, very small, but I have a just sick musical memory. I remember everything.
The milk is starting to get sour around here. The Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival youth concert that takes place Wednesday at 10 a.m., which is free at the St. Francis Auditorium, includes a performance by flutist Tara Helen O'Connor and harpist Rosalind Simpson. Story on that in today's Paso Tiempo.
And there's the music. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Robert Knott, thank you for being with us.
Wait,
were you in the middle
leaving?
Of something?
No, I was about to say goodbye, I guess.
I guess you were.
I didn't know it was already...
Hello, I must be going. Robert Knott is the associate editor of the Paso Tiempo Friday Arts Supplement in the Santa Fe... What? You're hassling me because I'm quoting Groucho Marx?
No, it's just that time flies when you're getting eradicated.
Well, we were cut a little short because we talked to the fellow from the ACLU before, so we didn't start as early
interview.
As we usually do.
It
Thank
was a
you.
Good interview.
We KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Don't forget, we're at 101.1 FM. Retune your radio dials. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Jazz a la Carta with Ricardo Perez. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. Hey, Robert Knott.
Yeah.
Have a wonderful weekend.
You too,
I still love you just the way you are.
I'm delighted.
Hasta la vista.
I'll see you around.